You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the US-China Trade War Podcast. I'm Finbar Birmingham on the political economy team here at the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong. The sun is shining here in Hong Kong and the mercury is rising. It is hot, hot, hot. And over the past few weeks, the city has become something of a geopolitical pressure cooker too, the latest front in the rivalry between the US and China. Right now, we're still waiting for the text of China's controversial national security law. Then we have to see what concrete measures Washington will take in response. We'll be watching that one closely for future episodes. This week, I'll be joined by a very special guest, Chad Bone, a trade economist at the Peterson Institute of International Economics and co-host of the really great Weekly Trade Talks podcast. Chad has been tracking whether China has been buying enough American goods to keep up with the Phase 1 trade deal targets. Spoiler alert, it hasn't. But we'll take a dive into the world of soybeans and oil to find out what the status is with that as we edge towards the midpoint of the year. I'll also first be speaking to John Carter, our political economy editor, and Teddy Ng, who's the China editor here at the South China Morning Post, to get a grasp on what's been happening on the US-China front over the past 2 weeks. We had some holiday last week and may have missed a few things, but we'll bring you right up to date on all the tweets, all the numbers, and all the stories on your weekly US-China Trade War podcast. Let's get going. Delighted to be joined in the studio today by Teddy Ng, who is China editor at the SCMP, and John Carter, political economy editor. John, it's been 2 weeks since we had our last podcast. We took a little break last week due to holiday, and it has been quite eventful. Over that time, we had a few reports from very well-established media that the Chinese government had ordered state buyers to stop purchasing US farm goods. Then the next day we saw some orders placed. Wee bit confusing. And then again this week we've had a whole load of soybeans being bought by Chinese buyers from the United States. What can we say about this situation? Are they buying or are they not?
It seems they're buying. The question is how much and over what period of time. They're still fairly well behind on their purchasing requirements to meet the what they've agreed to in the Phase 1 trade deal. But the reports that they had were going to stop buying, and that was in response to U.S. threats with regard to the Hong Kong new security law, threats by the United States that it would take away Hong Kong's trading privileges, and that this was China's counter-response. It turned out not to be true, at least not so far. The Chinese are buying, and it looks like they're buying more than they were before, which is a good sign. There's a seasonality to this, which I gather you'll get into later in the interview. But the trade deal seems to be alive and as well as it could be. That is to say, certain portions are doing well. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer pointed to the structural improvements in the Chinese economy, particularly the opening up of Chinese domestic financial markets, as a clear win from the trade deal. The agriculture purchase commitments are coming along, though they're still far behind, and the energy purchase commitments are way far behind, partly because of lower oil prices.
Yeah, we will get into that later with our guest this week. Just on that story about this government asking state buyers to stop, allegedly asking them to stop buying American goods, that is a real challenge. It shows the challenge for media covering China, right? Because both Bloomberg and Reuters reported this. Very, very reputable sources who we would trust, I would say, you know, among the best.
Right.
But I mean, it shows that the dearth of information that comes out of China, that whenever, I guess, a story like that comes out, it's really difficult to know where you stand.
Well, you have to be careful, and this is proof of that. But when you have sources that you trust, you assume that they are telling you the right story. It's not clear what happened with this story, which was reported by several news agencies, suggesting that the sources for it were authoritative. Mm-hmm. Was this a faction within the Chinese government trying to push their point of view? Was this actually something that was going to happen that was pulled back at the last minute? We don't know. What we do know is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is confirming that China is continuing to buy U.S. soybeans. And that is, you know, as we've reported since those reports that they would stop buying, China is complying with the deal subtly, quietly. It has shifted management of a portion of the deal from the Commerce Ministry, which is the ministry that negotiated the deal, to the Ag Ministry, which is doing the day-to-day. These are our supply needs. Let's go out and buy things.
Yeah. Teddy, turning to you on this one, what sort of noises are we hearing from officials or from spokespeople or from former government people about China's commitment to the trade deal?
Well, there are some signs that the trade deal is still going on. At least we have the former finance minister of China, Zhu Guangyao. He's suggesting that the two countries should not waste any time in improving relations to help better coordinate the response, first to the coronavirus pandemic, and also to move ahead what we call the economic cooperation between the two countries. This is what he said. The close connection between Chinese and the U.S. economies is the result of four decades of hard work on both sides, and that is also the reflection of the wishes of consumers in China and the U.S., and such interdependence will not disappear simply because some people are calling for decoupling. This is one of the signals we see that officials still want to go ahead with the trade deal.
Yeah, and this is a former official, but like, is it fair to say, Teddy, that these guys don't really come out and speak without implicit backing from current officials and the current government?
Yeah, they even though they have retired, but they still know what's going on.
They still know what's going on, indeed. John, we did have some official numbers last weekend. This was the China import-export data, trade balance and so on. Was there anything in there that we should know that would give us an indicator how the U.S.-China situation is going?
We had a sharp decline in imports into China, some of which, of course, are related to the trade deal. And we had a small decline in exports from China, which is what we've already understood, is that the foreign demand for Chinese products is going to wane in the months ahead because of the impact of the coronavirus on its biggest markets, the European Union and the United States. Imports into China fell more than 16% in May, an indication of, in part because of low oil prices, because China imports a lot of oil. And so the decline in oil prices meant the value of Chinese imports of oil were worth much less.
But there was a record volume, interestingly.
Yeah, no, they're buying a lot at low prices, which is smart business. But a lot of imports from other places were down as well, from both the United States and from Europe, indicating the weakness in domestic demand in China. The Chinese economy is still weak. And that's one of the reasons that China is not buying as much for the trade deal, is that there isn't the domestic demand at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's worth pointing out that U.S. imports, I think, fell 13.5% or something like that in May. And this is at a time when China's not just supposed to be buying more than last year, but more than 2017, which is before the trade war started. So, like, it's desperately far off meeting any sort of target for U.S. Purchases.
Right. And there is a force majeure portion of the agreement, meaning acts of God, like the coronavirus, allow you to set aside certain commitments in the deal. Now, there has been no formal acknowledgement of this, but I think there's an understanding that the pandemic has thrown a lot of projections out the window. You won't be able to meet them simply because of the impact of the virus. Having said that, there needs to be a show of good faith by both sides to comply with the deal, or the deal falls apart.
And yeah,
Teddy can speak to the importance of the deal as one of the single best ways for China and the U.S. to show goodwill, given the deterioration in relations elsewhere.
Yeah, and Teddy, that nice segue from John. I was going to ask you, because the rest of the relationship seems to be crumbling, right? You have all this really harsh rhetoric from both sides. The trade deal, you know, they're not doing very well in sort of buying the US goods, but it seems like both sides are talking it up and keen to keep hold of it. From your point of view and on your desk when you're working with your team, what have we seen over the past couple of weeks from these so-called wolf warriors who have really been quite forcefully criticizing the US in recent months on Twitter and on other social media?
Well, relations between the two countries is really bad. Really, really very bad. Well, some people say it's the worst in four decades. We have heard people even talking about the possibility of a hot war between China and the US.
Not even just a Cold War.
Not even just a Cold War. And like the risk of having the military confrontations over Taiwan is elevating. And the exchange of very tough rhetorics among both nations is very serious, especially since the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic.
Is there anything in the last couple of weeks? I mean, these wolf warriors, there doesn't seem to have been a big flashpoint between the US and China, but have they gone quiet or are they still being quite aggressive?
I think the tough criticisms each other has been sending to the other side is still continuous, especially on issues over Hong Kong, also on the coronavirus, also over US restrictions on Chinese firms, etc.
Yeah, so that's an ongoing thing. What about these guys elsewhere in the world? I was reading, was it the Brazilian ambassador this week coming out and making some fairly outlandish statements? I don't know, John or Teddy, who wants to discuss that one?
My understanding is that he, in Brazil, you understand, is one of the new hotspots for the virus in the world. The virus seems to have peaked, at least for now, in Europe and North America, but in South America, it is expanding. The Chinese ambassador to Brazil tweeted a conspiracy theory that the virus was engineered in a U.S. facility in Maryland, in the state of Maryland, and spread around the world. This is the latest in a series of conspiracy theories, honestly, from both sides, about where the virus originated, and it has helped sour relations between the two countries.
Great stuff. John, what are we looking out for economically in China this week?
On Monday, we're going to get what we call the data dump, which is industrial production, retail sales, and fixed asset investments. This is data that will tell us what's going on in the Chinese economy. Is there a gradual improvement in economic conditions, or have things leveled off? There are some indicators to suggest that there's been a plateauing. Industry came back strongly after the lockdowns, the end of the lockdowns, but because of the reduction in demand, particularly foreign demand, that production may have plateaued. I emphasize the word may. We'll see what we see. The Purchasing Managers Index, which is a index gauging sentiment in the economy, were very positive. So that could indicate that these numbers that we'll get on Monday would also be positive, but we will wait and see.
Great stuff. We look forward to hearing about that next week. Teddy, John, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm delighted to be joined by Chad Bone. Chad is Reginald Jones Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, where he has been an important authority on trade economics in recent years, and particularly from our end on US-China issues. Chad is a former White House and World Bank economist, and he's also co-host of the excellent Trade Talks podcast about the economics of trade policy. Chad recently launched the Phase 1 Trade Deal Tracker, which, as the name implies, tracks China's purchases of goods covered by the US trade deal. It's a really handy resource, and just to give one of the headline figures, through April 2020, China's year-to-date total imports of covered products from the United States were $26 billion, compared with a prorated year-to-date target of $57.6 billion. So Chad, just looking at that one figure, it seems as though things aren't really going according to plan, are they?
No, it really doesn't. And so first, let me say thanks for the opportunity to join you. It's a great pleasure. One of the reasons why we decided to create the phase one trade tracker, and it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, does it? I think we'll have to come up with a better name for it, is basically because this deal between the United States and China is so complicated. Not all trade is actually covered by this agreement. And so it's not as if you can just go out every month and look at the latest data release where China has, bought this many $1 billion worth of goods from the United States and just add it up and say, they're this much farther along than they were before. No, you actually have to match it up to products. It's only, about 70% of trade between the two countries, U.S. exports that are actually covered by this thing. So it takes a fair amount of work to actually look and update it each month. But the headline is, through the first 4 months of 2020, China's really, less than halfway to the sort of the year-to-date targets. So things aren't looking good so far.
Yeah. And we saw, I woke up to a barrage of tweets about how China's been buying more soybeans this week, and there has been more movement on pork and these sorts of things that China needs, right? Seems like the agricultural element of the deal is a priority and it seems to be moving well. But even on that front, Chad, like even soybeans and stuff like that, in the data that you covered up to April, certainly nowhere near where they need to be, even on the most simple front.
Yeah, that's right. So the agriculture component, so the deal, is split out into four separate chunks. There's a sub-target for manufactured products. There's a sub-target for energy products. There's a sub-target for trade and services. And then the big one, of course, for President Trump especially, is the sub-target for agriculture. And for just agriculture, China's somewhere between 40 to 50% of the year-to-date target, so they're already behind there as well. Soybeans is historically, the largest American farm export product to China. I think there's a lot of reasons why that's likely to be down. One of which, obviously, is the trade war itself. But another big part of that is, what's happened with China's hog population. It's pigs that have been decimated by the sort of the African swine fever, and so demand for soybean products is down. That being said, in the United States, that's also a crop that is harvested late in the year, so September, October, November, and so I think that's one of those things that, if anything, you may expect to see some of those sales tend to pick up toward the end of the year. The one positive is pork. They're never going to reach the targets in and of themselves by just buying pork, but the pork numbers this year, and obviously because of the African swine fever problem as well, those exports are way up for the United States.
Yeah. Do you read anything into the record volumes of purchases of Brazilian soybeans? And I know this is where we get into the sort of seasonality of it. Southern hemisphere crops have been online. North American crops will come online post-September. But should we read anything into the fact that a lot of Chinese buyers appear to have bought as much as they need till August and stocked up an awful lot on Brazilian soybeans? Does that sort of maybe seep into what potentially could come from America later in the year?
Yeah, I think it possibly could. I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind with the phase one deal in and of itself, surprisingly, didn't get rid of all of those tariffs that China had put on the United States during the trade war. If you're a private Chinese buyer and you're looking around the world, you don't want to buy stuff from the United States in a lot of cases because you're still facing a 25% tariff if you buy it from them. But if you buy it from Brazil, it's the normal 3% tariff. So I think that's still a big issue. Now, you can get around that if the Chinese government says, well, we're going to, we can direct the state-owned enterprises, the big purchasing companies that are state-owned to buy those types of products, and we'll just, rebate the tariff revenue to them. But I think there are some private sector disincentives to look at the American product and to look elsewhere.
Yeah. One of the really disappointing elements of the deal has been energy. And look, in my really reductive fashion, I looked at this at the start and I thought, well, you know, China's the biggest importer of oil. The US has lots of oil. Surely that's going to be one of the easiest ones to achieve. But your tracker shows that it's, just going to have a quick look. It was something like, as of April, it was like 0.2 billion. Out of 25.3, it was way, way behind. I mean, it's just nowhere near where it needs to be. Obviously, that is very reductive. There are other, you know, challenges. But does this sort of set out the fallacy of partially this deal is that these targets were far too ambitious, that, you know, there maybe isn't that compatibility between some US products and what China imports? What's going on with the energy there?
I think there's a couple of big pieces to the energy story. So first of all, the targets in and of themselves, I think, are unrealistic. And, you know, for essentially reasons of American capacity. So there were reports back in February in the United States that, you know, one of the big lobby groups, the American Petroleum Institute, actually, you know, went to the Trump administration and said, look, we just don't have the capacity to, you know, to get all this LNG or, you know, oil or coal, you know, the big products in the energy category to get it to China, you know, even if they were willing to buy it. So that's the first thing. The second thing, though, is the deal is written in value terms, in dollar terms, and energy prices, as we know, with the crisis, fell off a cliff. And so if the price of oil is zero, you know, even if China, you know, buys all the barrels of oil that the Americans can pull out of the ground, at a price of zero, the value of that thing is zero. So, you know, this is the fault of the way the American negotiators wrote the agreement in and of itself as well. But yeah, no, they're less than 10% of the way year to date to targets for energy, and it's not looking good there either.
The oil price is important because we were always told, you know, when the Chinese negotiating team or the ministry commented on talks throughout and even after the deal was signed, that this would all depend on market conditions. And I suppose the oil price is the real go-to there. Although you will have seen in May, they imported record volumes of crude. Although we haven't seen the granular breakdown of that, when I speak with analysts who know the sector, they suspect most of it came from the Gulf and Russia. So to me, that also shows that maybe China isn't that serious about buying US oil either. But the market conditions point, Chad, seems a very pertinent one here. And is this part of the dangers maybe of having these managed trade agreements is that they don't always work out when reality bites?
That's exactly right. There's so many problems with these managed trade agreements, but that's exactly one of them. Though I think, you know, almost ironically, you know, for many folks, when they were originally thinking about what that sort of market conditions clause in the agreement might mean and why it might have been inserted in there, it was for the opposite reason. They were very concerned, say, that Americans would be withholding supplies of certain products in order to drive up prices. And China didn't want to be held responsible for, you know, buying stuff if prices were just going to be exorbitant and beyond, you know, what the world price was. Nobody foresaw when this thing was written and signed back in January that COVID was going to hit. There was going to be this massive global recession and that just prices of everything were not everything, but a lot of products were going to decline sharply.
Yeah. COVID, obviously the elephant in the room. How much do you sort of blame the pandemic for what we have seen in terms of China's levels of purchasing?
I think it's hard to put an exact number on it, obviously, but it's going to play a big part. You know, that being said, there are some products in there that China's imports have gone up, perhaps unexpectedly for, you know, healthcare products because of the crisis. So, you know, not everything is most of it is on the negative side, but it's not all the case. You know, that being said, you know, the role that the pandemic is ultimately going to play with the politics of this deal, I think are still to be realized as well. So, you know, I get asked this question a lot, but, you know, one way to think about it is because the purchase targets were really so unrealistic, it's even before the crisis, highly unlikely China was going to be able to meet them. And it very much looked like this was just a deal for President Trump to be able to have something to campaign on before the election. But with the crisis, you know, if it looks like China's not going to reach the deal, if they aren't going to reach the deal, now the Trump administration has, you know, a sort of an excuse, a get out of jail free card, you know, that it could offer up and say, ah, you know, we want to keep this deal going. Or let me put it differently. If they want to keep the deal going and they're nowhere close on the purchase targets, now they have a hand wrapped excuse that they can put out there and say, you know, it's not the deal's fault. It's COVID-19's fault.
Yeah. And this was also, of course, early on in the outbreak, seems like years ago now, I think it was about 4 months ago, everybody was talking about this force majeure clause that the agreement contains, that, you know, both sides can consult if it doesn't look as though the agreement's going to be possible. And from what I know, it doesn't look like this has been invoked yet, and it doesn't look like anybody has the intention to do so. I mean, your point there about President Trump basically using this as an electioneering a tool, yeah, something to maybe, you know, trumpet when he's on the campaign trail. At what point does the trade deal become a net negative in terms of Trump's base, given the way that the political mood has soured towards China, and it seems like China's going to form a real crucial part of the election this year? At what point does this trade deal become a handicap in those terms?
Well, I mean, that to some extent, the purchase targets, the way they're written, and especially in the agricultural purchases, especially, you know, tending to occur later in the year when sort of the crops come in the United States, you know, we won't know until well after the election whether or not China got close or not. You know, so we're sort of providing you know, prorated targets, but there's nothing in the deal that says they have to meet this much by any given month or any given quarter or anything, just by sort of the end of the year. So there's nothing in the deal that really suggests that. I think obviously the bigger issue is going to be, you know, how President Trump is faring during the campaign on a lot of other issues. Obviously, COVID has sort of led to a new economic crisis in the United States. We know from 2016 and through the first 3 years of the administration that a very popular, for President Trump at least, go-to when he needs to rally his base, when he needs to, you know, look tough on some issue, is to go after trade and to go after China. And so, you know, I think partially it will depend on what happens with the Biden campaign, how hard they attack on China, if they're, you know, attacking the Trump administration as having been weak on China, either, you know, response to the pandemic or with this trade deal. You may see President Trump, you know, kind of have to push away from this deal and, you know, to be seen to be acting tougher on China, if he thinks that will gain, you know, traction for him politically. So I think that's something that's, you know, I don't think we can discount that is happening between now and November.
And just to finish up, Chad, I want to ask you, because it seems as though on the USTR front, Ambassador Lighthizer has been still very supportive of this. He's come out and he said, you know, China is making good progress, even though we can see from your tracker that they're not maybe buying as much as they should. They have actually made some market liberalization where they've allowed US poultry, US beef, US pet food, stuff like that. You know, they've sort of allowed those into the Chinese market. What do you read into Lighthizer's comments? Is it really just trying to rally behind the deal that he's negotiated, or is there real substance to his comments?
Well, I think there is a big part of that. I think, you know, he probably looks at this agreement as part of his legacy, something that, you know, he was able to accomplish as the point person. You know, he has very, very strong feelings about China, and obviously is a very capable negotiator. Whether or not you disagree or agree with, you know, the positions that he takes and his view of the world, and I disagree with them strongly, but I think he's in many respects a brilliant negotiator, and obviously knows his trade law. And I think there is some element that, you know, this is his deal, and he, you know, for all intents and purposes, would like for it to stick, for it to be given the chance to stick. And so I agree. He's come out repeatedly and said, you know, China is making progress on these other things. The financial services liberalization, some of the reforms that they're making, and you know, they're making some progress. And he has been the one that sort of said, look, you know, they've had to deal with this pandemic as well. And that being said, they're making some purchases.
Sure. And just to finish off, Chad, I'm going to ask you for a one-line trigger response to this term, phase two.
What? Yeah, we haven't heard anything about phase two since, I don't know, January or February. Yeah, radio silence on that one.
So, Chad, before we finish up, where can people find you on Twitter, and tell people where they can find your podcast too?
So on Twitter, I'm at Chad Bown. And my podcast with Samaya Keynes is called Trade Talks. And our Twitter handle is at @trade_talks. That's two underscores because two is better than one.
Yeah. And just because this is going to be an audio interview, I want to just tell everybody that Chad is wearing his Trade Talks fleece. He's wearing his jackets, his zip up. So he's very much on brand.
Even though it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit here in Washington, D.C., indeed, I'm wearing it proudly.
Wow, that is commitment. I'm sure your co-host will be delighted to hear. But great stuff, Chad. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the US-China Trade War Podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham. You can follow us on Twitter at SCMP Economy. I'm at F Birmingham. That's Birmingham with a B-E-R, not like the city. Please keep track on SCMP.com for live updates on all things Hong Kong, all things trade war, and all things coronavirus. And we'll see you back here next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to SCMP.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.